Evangelical Political Liberalism, the 10th talk in a series titled Modern Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 4, 1996, at an evening class in McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Get started. See, I need to define some terms, but I'll define them as I go, I think, rather than bore you with definitions right up front. What is liberalism? And first of all, I want to talk about political liberalism in the context of evangelical Christianity. So what I'm talking about would be Tom Sein, Ron Sider, Tony Campola, Sojourners Magazine, stuff like that. If you're not familiar with that, then you don't know what I'm talking about. If you are familiar with that, then you know roughly what I'm talking about. I'll try to give you a feel for what I'm talking about as we go otherwise. But what I want to do first is define what I think is very, very difficult to define, actually, is liberalism generally, traditional liberalism, traditional political liberalism, not in an evangelical context, but in a historical context. And then I'll move from there to show how that has influenced evangelical community. Traditional liberalism, it seems to me, can probably best be defined as simply the belief in individual liberties as over against governmental control over the conditions of a person's life. So it's just someone who believes in sometimes natural rights. It's not always based on natural rights, but in any case, whatever they use as the theoretical foundation, believing that individual particular people ought to be free to believe what they want to believe, to follow their conscience, to speak, to get together with other people of like-minded, and any number to vote, to have a say in the form of government, in the governmental control of their life, to have some kind of say in that. Those kinds of things that we typically think of as freedoms and liberties in a political sense. Traditional liberalism is simply advocating that individual people have those kinds of liberties and those kinds of freedom. Now, in that sense, all modern political attitudes in this country with I can't think of any exceptions, are liberal. That is, are consistent with traditional liberalism. Because the alternative to traditional liberalism is not conservatism, that at least not conservatism as we think of that today. The opposite of traditional liberalism is not conservatism. The opposite of traditional liberalism would be the authority of the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope, or the authority of the absolute monarch, who's the king, or the authority of some kind of aristocracy, some kind of set of nobles and lords who really basically have total control over the economy and over property and over land and over possessions and on and on and on and on. So traditional liberalism happened as a result of the Enlightenment. I'll talk about that in a second, but as a result of the Enlightenment in Europe, where they were coming out of the Middle Ages, coming out of a feudal system, coming out of a system that had kings and monarchs and aristocrats, and was awakening to the notion that maybe individual human beings, particular human beings, even the serfs, were actually more important than that. That they were more important than to just be pawns in the policies and the will of some monarch somewhere. They were more important than that. And in that reaction was born what we think of historically as liberalism. So when we think of conservatives and liberals in this nation today, that's an in-house fight between liberals. It's a question of what kind of liberal are you, not whether or not you are a liberal. Because in the historical traditional sense, everybody in America today is a liberal, in that sense. Is that clear? That the difference between conservative and liberal, as we think of it in the debate today then, concerns the nature and degree of individual liberty. That is that individual liberty boundless and without any boundaries and completely in absolute liberty, or are there some built-in boundaries? The conservatives are going to opt for there are some boundaries, and an extreme liberal in our society today would say there are no boundaries whatsoever, and that there may be gradations in between. But that's one of the issues. To what's the degree and nature of the individual liberty that people have? And a second issue is the degree of importance of social justice and social equality and a few other litmus test issues. I'll get more into that when we talk about evangelical liberalism. So I mentioned that traditional liberalism has its roots in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was a time in history where I think basically its roots come in the brilliant notion that maybe the church doesn't know what it's talking about, fundamentally. Because up until the time of the Enlightenment, Europe was completely was a monolithic society, completely dominated by the philosophy, the doctrines, the beliefs, the institutions of the Roman Catholic Church. And there came a time, there had always been some kind of dissent throughout the Middle Ages. There had always been theologians who had some kind of offbeat things to say and some rather unorthodox things to say. But the Roman Catholic Church had always managed to kind of reach out and include them, a lot like the history of Hinduism. I mean, Hinduism was amazing for its ability to, oh, you're a Christian? Oh, yeah, well, Christianity is Hindu, too. And able to take anything and everything and just sort of make it a part of what it is. And the Roman Catholic Church, to a certain extent today, but especially in the Middle Ages, has had that kind of genius to it as well. You're a mystic? Oh, that's fine. That's Christian. You're an ascetic? You're a monk? Yeah, that's part of it too. As long as it has the church's blessing on it, it really didn't make any difference that what this person is saying over here and what this person is saying over here, both Roman Catholics, are completely and fundamentally in disagreement with each other on every possible point. But the fact that they both have the blessing of the church makes it all Christianity. It's all okay. But there was this wellspring in kind of the forces, the historical forces in Europe, that at the time of the Enlightenment, see, what are we talking about? We're talking about, I was going to say 17th century, late 1600s, mid to late 1600s, and on, yeah. Where you had scholar after scholar, philosopher after philosopher, intellectual after intellectual, artist after artist, just a profusion of people who were calling into question the authority of the church. And in large part, they were calling into question the authority of the church because there had come to be this renewed confidence in human reasoning. That is, I don't need the church to tell me what to believe. I've got a brain. I can figure out what's true. I can figure out what's right and what's good and what's reasonable. And what fueled it probably more than anything else was the advance of modern science. Newton. Newton's to blame. Because Newton, the clever guy, used his mind, used mathematics, used his reasoning to solve and unravel incredible mysteries of the universe. Principles of gravity, principles of motion, principles of thermodynamics, and all kinds of things. And he was a genius, I mean, a remarkable man. And what happened in the culture was, look, if he can do that in science, can't we do that in religion? Can't we do that in social philosophy? Can't we do that in economics? Can't we do that in... And they began to think, look, the only reason we can't do the same thing and come to the same degree of knowledge and clarity that Newton did in physics is we just haven't tried it, so let's have at it. And the last thing we want to do is to have the church dictating to us what we must believe and how we must think and how we must proceed. We can figure that out. We don't need the church telling us what to do. So it's called the Enlightenment because that was their own spirit. That was their own attitude toward this thing. In fact, the word Enlightenment comes out of a preface to a book, I think, by Kant, actually. I don't remember. But he himself gives expression, whoever this philosopher is, gives expression to this attitude that we're no longer a kind of poor, repressed, mindless, benighted culture and group of people. We're free now to allow our minds to expand the horizons of our knowledge. We can go out and learn and know what is true. Now, it's very difficult to criticize the Enlightenment. And what I mean is I don't intend to. I mean, I think it was wonderful what happened there. I think they were right. They were absolutely right. But what's critical to see are two things. One is that implicit in the Enlightenment was a certain underlying attitude that was unnecessary, but was a part of the attitude of the Enlightenment, and that was a rejection of the church's authority, in effect a kind of rebellion against the church's authority. One could have reconsidered the nature of their authority without rebelling against it, if you see what I'm saying. One could have got the same place that the Enlightenment got without the kind of anti-authoritarian spirit that marked many of the Enlightenment thinkers. There was a kind of hostility and a kind of rebellion and a kind of uppityness in spirit that marked many of these thinkers.
Would you say that was a reaction to being burned at the stake, that kind of thing?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
You mean like in the 60s, when they didn't replace the structure with something, they just tore down the old structure? I mean, that's the way I remember the 60s.
You mean, is that what happened in the Enlightenment? No, they actually replaced it with new institutions and new structures.
Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yes and no. Yes, I think there was a similar spirit, but no, the effect and the result and the accomplishments were different. In that, I think they actually did replace, like, monarchy with democracy, for example, and formed the modern state. Whether that was good or bad, more history will tell. But formed what we think of as the modern state, and there are all kinds of different a change in the institutions that characterize modern culture that made it a very different world than the world that they came out of. So they really did constructively build something different. They didn't just tear it down. But my point is a more subjective, less tangible kind of thing. There really was an uppityness of spirit that, look, I don't need anyone to tell me what to think and what to do. They didn't reject all authority because they believed in the authority of their own reason. Now, I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's what I think gets rejected by modern liberalism. Modern liberalism keeps the uppityness of spirit, but no longer buys the authority of reason. It really doesn't buy the authority of anyone or anything. And so what keeps someone like John Locke sane, reasonable, sensible, and so on in his perspectives is that he maintained his belief in the authority of God, he maintained his belief in the authority of scriptures, and he very much believed in the authority of reason. But out of an anti-authoritarian spirit, you could just as easily rebel against the authority of Scripture, the authority of God, and the authority of reason as you could the authority of the Pope and the King. If at the heart of this thing is anti-authoritarianism as such, then where do you draw the line? Where do you stop? And what I would argue is that the momentum of that traditional liberalism started gets carried over into the modern times, not in the form of rejecting monarchy in favor of democracy, etc., but rather in the form of a belief that no individual should be under the authority and within the confines and the boundaries of anyone or anything, a kind of anti-authoritarian spirit.
Can I ask you, Jack, then, in the Enlightenment, was it was not then specifically a rebellion against God then?
No, not at all.
But the rebellion against God and the whole attitude was, as far as like God is dead type of attitude, was something that had come over a period of time.
Later,
just developed. When did that start to come in? Did it come into Europe first?
The death of God.
Well, as far as, you know, rebelling against God type of attitude.
Well, I won't say that there weren't seeds of it in the Enlightenment. Someone like Hume, for example, is very much, David Hume, a British philosopher, is very much a anti-religion, anti-God kind of philosophy. So it's there, but on the other hand, you know, he's side by side with someone like a philosopher like Bishop Berkeley and Thomas Reed, who are very much Christians and very much theists, I mean, very much submitted to the authority of God and to Scripture. And John Locke, his predecessor, was very much committed to the authority of Scripture. So you had individuals who were beginning to play with the idea of, you know, maybe this God stuff is nonsense. But it really didn't take root until, that didn't really take root until this century and become a culture-wide phenomenon until the early part of this century.
Even in Europe.
Now, what they replaced it with was not healthy. I mean, it was not... They brought God into the picture, but... it wasn't really the God of the Bible, so...
Let me get my history straight here now. The French Revolution came after the Enlightenment, then?
It's on the tail end of the Enlightenment. It's in a sense what put an end to the Enlightenment. It's hard to be uppity. It was hard to be uppity when they saw the atrocities of the French Revolution. They got to thinking, maybe we're not as enlightened as we think we are. Yeah. Now, it put an end to the Enlightenment per se, but it didn't put an end to influences from the Enlightenment that are still with us to this very day. Okay, so I mentioned there's two things about the Enlightenment to keep in mind. One is this kind of anti-authoritarian seed, which is important to recognize. The second one is this... And maybe I'm stretching it here, so take this with a grain of salt, but it makes sense to me. This whole idea of enlightenment, the idea that there are really two kinds of people. There are people who get it, and there's people who don't. And who are the people that get it? Well, the people that get it are the people that are for human liberties, human rights, individual liberties, freedom, and that stuff. And then there are those who oppose that stuff. Well, why do they oppose it? Well, they're not enlightened. And it's just remarkable to me that down to this very day, you really clearly have two classes of people in our society. There are the enlightened people, the people with the moral high road, the people where right and goodness and humanity and truth is on their side, and then there are the other people. Well, who are the good guys? Liberals. It's clearly the liberals that are the good guy in modern society. Conservatives are always Nazis, fascists, racists, rednecks, country bumpkins, hillbillies. You know, the reason they think the way they think is because somebody married their sister and they're uneducated. They've never gone to college. They're uneducated. Someone like William Buckley is always kind of brushed off as a real anomaly. I mean, he inhaled or something. I mean, first of all, who can understand what he's saying anyway? And he's just an anomaly. But anyone else is a vicious, ignorant, evil person. I saw a bumper sticker today. What was it? I think it was liberate freedom. And I thought, my goodness, this country's bad, and this country has a lot of problems, But of all the things to wear on your car in this country, liberate freedom? There's someone who obviously wants absolutely no boundaries whatsoever if they think that freedom needs to be liberated in this country. I mean, that's just incredible. And then the other bumper sticker, let's see, what was I just talking about? I won't be able to reconstruct it, but the gist of it is, if people would just not be ignorance is the worst hate crime, or ignorance is that ringing a bell? Something about connecting hate crimes and ignorance or something like that. And there's another one that basically basically it says if you just get an education, then you wouldn't be the fascist Nazi pig that you are. You just get an education. Well, I mean, that's so clearly the sentiment of our culture. Yeah, I think. Isn't that right? Yeah.
I don't want to draw you from the tangents of this.
That's okay. I welcome that.
If this could be addressed later, that's fine. I've just read Stott's Contemporary Christian and been reading some old versions of Christianity Today about the whole issue of the social gospel. And I guess evangelicalism's roots being kind of having an aversion to that.
Right.
Does some of that relate to this whole idea of liberalism?
It will. Yeah. I'll get there. But
okay.
Ask that again if I haven't adequately answered that in a second. Yeah. The point I wanted to make in this regard is, as I say, maybe I'm stretching it, but it seems to me that there must be a historical thread and a correlation between the birth of liberalism and the Enlightenment and this whole idea that it is the intellectual, it is the academic, it is the intellectual elite, it is the enlightened one who will be a liberal. And it is the ignorant, still in his uneducated confusion, that's going to be a conservative. Never mind that what it would mean to be an unenlightened conservative would be to believe in the monarchy. Never mind that. Never mind that no conservative in this country believes in monarchy, or at least I don't think so. But nonetheless, that kind of division has just got carried down and is still with us. Different content has been given to the word liberal than it had originally, but the same mentality toward who would be a liberal has been maintained. What I want to call the modern liberalism, or the modern liberal attitude, there's another important thing I think to say about it, and that is its character. I think it can best be characterized as a kind of as perhaps a kind of allergy. Let's see, where do I define that? Okay, yeah, it's more like a mood than it is a theory. Conservatives have political theory. Conservatives have a worldview. And I critiqued it last week. And I think, although there's a tremendous overlap between political conservatism and biblical Christianity, nonetheless, ultimately, the theory of political conservatism is not the biblical worldview. It's very different. But liberalism, you can't do the same thing with liberalism, because liberalism doesn't really present... There are different, more or less, liberal political theories, but liberalism as such, I think, seems to me to be best characterized as a mood and an attitude, and ultimately as a kind of allergic reaction, rather than as a social theory. And here's what I mean by that. It's more like a social disposition to leave people alone to do their own thing, on the one hand, and to violently oppose anyone or anything that interferes with the liberty of another person or thing, or the well-being of another person or thing. It's kind of that two-pronged allergy. I want to leave you alone, and I want everyone else to leave you alone, and in fact, the only thing I'm going to get upset about is if you won't leave you alone, or you won't leave him alone. Then I'm going to oppose your interference in his liberty and in his well-being. It's that kind of mood and that kind of attitude that is really kind of the only unifying character of liberalism as such, it seems to me. Notice that liberals do not typically refute the arguments of conservatives. They don't argue against conservative theory. I have yet to see a liberal, at least in the modern climate, do that. Instead, they condemn the person as being mean-spirited and inhumane. Right? It's almost always an ad hominem. They never make an argument about why their theory is better than the conservative theory.
Is that what brings about this comment? If you have a theology, keep it to yourself.
Mm. Yeah, probably.
And the other, if you doctrine is the reason there's problems between the churches.
Yeah, there's probably a relationship, because it's sort of a liberal attitude to not let something like theory, so theory like as dogma and doctrine and scriptural teaching and biblical teaching, to kind of interfere with people being able to do their own thing.
Let's study the Bible for its truths.
Yeah, whatever that's supposed to mean after that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Andy? It seems like modern liberalism, modern political liberalism, within that, the people usually emphasize more interference in people's lives, though, as far as government programs.
Absolutely, that's the irony. Yeah.
And right, well, that's what I was going to say. How does that fit in with your definition then?
Because well, I sort of haven't got there. Another component that's not a part of, it's not really a part of traditional liberalism, but it's become married with modern liberalism, is what we, I don't know what else to call it except maybe left-wing political ideals. And anymore, what we think of in America as a liberal is really left-wing. And what I mean by that, left-wing political ideas have to do with a certain attitude toward the government's role, as well as individual's role, but individual people's role and the government's role in bringing about social justice, economic justice, equal distribution of wealth, supposedly the elimination of something like poverty, the elimination of racism, the elimination of prejudice, basically addressing social ills, a certain view about the degree and nature of the importance of doing so, and a certain view of who and how that should be done that needs to be addressed by the government. Those are left-wing political ideals. Socialism, if you want to call it socialism, but But in modern American liberalism, there's been married to and joined with the traditional liberal ideals, which even conservatives will accept and buy, the left wing has veered off to become not just liberal, but to become left wing, to be socialistic. Whereas conservatives are liberal in the historical traditional sense, but they veer the other direction in terms of rejecting socialism as an answer and the ideals of socialism. They just don't see the ideals of socialism as right.
So modern political liberals don't fall under liberal, they fall under left wing then, more so.
Well, both, because they haven't...
I don't hear the modern liberals saying what you're saying, though, about leave me alone, you know,
well,
type of thing.
Yeah, but they are, in this sense. I mean, you see, one of the things I talked about in the typical liberal attitude is a violent opposition to your interfering in her rights. And I'm so violently opposed to that, I want the government to come and tell you to leave her alone. So my socialism tells me, let's get the government involved here. My liberalism tells me one of the important things for the government to do is to make sure that you're not a racist, to make sure that you're not being economically unjust, being socially unjust and discriminatory and so on and so forth. And so I'm going to have the government make all kinds of boundaries and rules that you and hoops for you to jump through to make sure that other people's individual liberties are maintained. But the goal of those policies is supposedly the individual liberties of other people. So you see, that's still maintaining the spirit of liberalism, but it's joining it to this left-wing socialist agenda. You look confused.
Do I?
Yeah, but that's I mean, you're not. I'll take your word for it.
It's probably normal.
Okay.
I understand everything you said, but I can't see how people can, in their mind, get those two together.
It's not like ACLU.
Well, ACLU is a paradigm is the paradigm of modern liberalism, American liberalism.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing you always come up against is that things that people talk about on talk radio, for example, that the kind of things that come up, you can't argue against eliminating poverty, sickness, hunger. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you argue against that kind of stuff?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm getting at in terms of the liberal response to a conservative. I mean, the liberal response is, I mean, it's almost as if conservatives would just be honest. Yes, I vote for racism. I vote for poverty. I hope people die. I mean, I really want people to starve to death. I mean, I just think that would be great. It's as if the conservatives are for everything that they're trying to be against. Obviously, that's not the issue. The issue is, how do you fight poverty? How do you fight racism? How do you fight injustice? It's a question of strategy and policy and goals, not ends. All of them share the same liberal ends of addressing, or most of the same liberal ends. So,
but they're based on their theory of human nature and human responsibility. And the whole anthropologies are different. One group will say, we will make this utopia, and the other group will say, we will allow this utopia if we're willing to make it. You know what I'm saying? Well, it seems to me the liberals are going to force us into utopia, whether we want it or not. And the conservatives say, we can do this if we want, but we shouldn't force anybody to do it. I mean, if we all get together and have a consensus and say, okay, let's create this utopian society, then we all work together to create it. Whereas the other group will say, well, you're going to do it whether you want it or not, whether you want to work towards it or not, whether you want to participate in it or not.
Yeah, and I think what I'm saying is, where does that kind of dogmatism come from? Because they're enlightened. I think it's no accident. It comes because they are the enlightened ones. Why should they... You know, why should they wait for me? Because I'm an ignorant, redneck fool. Why should they wait for me? So I think that...
Me too, yeah.
What is Jack... I don't know if this makes any sense. What's the difference then? Obviously, society makes laws against, you know, rape, against murder, and so on and so forth.
Well, see, modern liberalism really has a difficult time here. Because modern liberalism, unlike traditional liberalism, see, traditional liberalism had a very, very easy answer for that. It's not because God said don't do it. It's not because natural law, well, I mean, they might even appeal to natural law, but it's not because the church or God say don't do it. It's because my reason tells me that that's wrong. That's uncivilized, it's destructive to human life and experience and so on. We don't need anyone to tell us that it's wrong. We know it's wrong just by the clear light of reason. Well, modern Americans have abandoned the idea that there even is such a thing as rationality at all. And they're going to, that's why you get such utter, incredible confusion in liberal thought today. I mean, how do you make sense? How can you possibly make sense out of the same mentality objects strongly to the clubbing of little baby seals and thinks it's some kind of victory when women can kill the fetus in their womb? How can you possibly make any sense out of that? Except that it's ultimately arbitrary. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. It's ultimately a question of fashion. Modern liberalism is faddish. And it just depends on what the fashion says as to what you are and are not going to be outraged by, what you are and are not going to accept or exclude or whatever. It's no longer the clear light of reason, however, that is dictating how we should behave and how we should think and what laws we should pass and that kind of thing. Traditional liberalism had a very important check on this freedom, namely, what does reason tell us? But that's no longer true because we don't even believe in reason any longer.
Can I ask you a question? I don't know if you can answer this. It just popped into my mind if you can answer this real quick or not. But, of course, some of the books I've read on history, Christians want to say that our country was, as we discussed before, was based upon the biblical and ethical, so on and so forth, of Scripture. Some even believe that it's supposed to be the new Israel. Then there, but the more liberal concept, what I understand, or left wing, what do you want to call it, is that our country was actually born out of an Enlightenment idea. Is a little bit of, do you think that a little bit of both of those are right?
Yeah, absolutely. The founding fathers included devout Christians who were immersed in the common sense philosophy of Thomas Reed and his fellow Scottish intellectuals. That was very, very influential in the thought of a lot of the Presbyterian Christians who were instrumental in the founding of this country. On the other hand, you have a Benjamin Franklin and a Thomas Jefferson who are not Christians at all. But they're very enamored by the ideas of the Enlightenment. But it just also so happens that biblical Christianity and Enlightenment ideals overlap tremendously. Christians, biblical Christians, to this day, including me, can be very supporting of many of the ideas and principles and goals of the Enlightenment. I mean, as I said earlier, I think the Enlightenment was a great thing. And I say that as a biblical Christian. I mean, I think it allowed for a lot of real spiritual darkness to be dispelled. I think that's true.
But the hang-up was this propensity and this hatred for authority.
At least that seed there that people later can run with.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I'm still basically trying to spin out this idea that liberalism is an allergy. I think it's an allergic reaction to boundaries and limitations of any kind. Basically, that's the basic liberal spirit and the basic liberal mentality. And that bumper sticker that we were talking about is part of that. The other one, subvert the dominant paradigm. Or question authority is the one I love. Yeah, question authority, who says? In this respect, if I'm right about that, and this is part of my basic fundamental critique from a biblical Christian standpoint, modern liberalism is inherently evil insofar as it's an allergic reaction to boundaries and limitations of any kind. To the extent that rightly characterizes it, to that extent it's inherently evil. Because one of the fundamental characteristics of the evil heart is its rebellion against the very real boundaries and limitations which God has imposed on all of us. And all of us have one kind or another of limitations and boundaries. I'm too stupid to do some things. I'm too lacking in talent to do other things. I mean, my brother David used to tease about suing the NBA because they were discriminating against him just because he couldn't play basketball. I mean, we laugh about that kind of thing, but... But what?
Modern liberals wouldn't laugh.
No, exactly. I mean, they might, but the only reason they wouldn't laugh at that is because they know that that's not a fashionable cause. But if it were a fashionable cause, it would make the causes that are fashionable sometimes make about that much sense. Or not much more sense than that. And so it's this attitude that, look, don't limit people. Don't put boundaries on them. So they're not talented? Hey, if they want the opportunity, give it to them. Give them the freedom to follow their whim and to follow their desire and to do what they want to do and to do their own thing. And don't you dare stand in the way of them doing that. That's the kind of allergic reaction that I'm talking about. It's just this basic fundamental kind of reaction to, hey, let them be free. So in the end, liberalism tends to see individual impulse as the arbiter of social ethics, so long as my individual impulses do not harm anyone else. That's the one and only absolute that they will offer as a limitation. And that's really only a theoretical limitation sometimes. So long as my individual impulses do not harm anyone else, and I agree that it isn't anyone else, yeah.
Is that kind of bring itself in there?
Yeah.
The feeling replaces reason?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, because I really don't think reason has much to do with any of this.
Yeah.
As I say, it's not a theoretical position. It's an attitude driven by fashions.
Coupled with God told me to, so therefore now you can't question me. Mm-hmm. Like when the Vineyards and other charismatics have said, God told me to put my hands on my head and spin around and I would get a blessing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's real. I heard that on the radio.
Did he say something?
The big man himself.
You're fooling for Christ?
The big man himself?
Yeah, Jack
Hayford.
Hayford.
Really?
Yeah, he said that, and then later on, I read where the Vineyards had were doing that. So now I know which God it was told him. Okay. And he did it, yeah. And he said he got a blessing.
Oh, good for him.
Jack, you know what to me is scary in a lot of ways is like when we look at things like murder, like you're talking about there, killing and so on, it's how a person wants to define what murder is. Whether it be abortion, assisted suicide, let's start defining all these things. And if there's no definition on them, then everything's open. Okay, let's go out and kill some Muslims and Christians today because they are not politically correct or whatever it is. Or let's go out and kill some whoever else they are.
Mosquitoes.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, that is where it could ultimately lead, because ultimately the attitude that I'm enlightened and you're not can't end in the absence of any moral principles, in the absence of rationality, in the absence of any of the normal restraints, can easily lead to, let's just eliminate you, and then it'll only be us enlightened people left. So that's why these liberal ideas, whenever they have been worked out into actual nations and states, have always been totalitarian and repressive, oppressive governments.
What history shows us.
I think so. I don't think there's any question about that. Let's look at the faddish character of modern liberalism. I already mentioned it. It was striking. There, Rush Limbaugh has made a career, has made himself wealthy over this fact about liberalism. It is rife with hypocrisy because it is not based on principles. It is a completely unprincipled point of view. There can be a hardline censure against South Africa for its policies, for its apartheid policies, and we can wear ribbons about that and make speeches at Academy Award ceremonies about that. At the same time, that equally outrageous human rights violations are happening in the Soviet Union, and our attitude toward the Soviet Union is rather sympathetic. Now, what principle is being applied here? Well, I don't think there's any principle being applied. I don't think there's any principle being applied at all. It's just a question of what's hip and cool and groovy to make as a cause of social injustice. Is it really social injustice? Absolutely. Apartheid really, really as evil as they say? Well, I don't know, but probably. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if it was. I don't know firsthand, but probably. It was probably a terrible thing. But so was the persecution of the Jews in the Soviet Union, a terrible thing. Equally outrageous. No question it was equally outrageous. Yeah, yeah.
Isn't there also the dynamic of what are my chances of winning and what's it going to cost me? If we go up against a country the size of South Africa with our economic might, we're probably going to win. If we protest in the streets, we get our pictures on the paper and in TV. If, on the other hand, we go up against the Soviet Union and make a big issue out of this, we're dealing at that time with what we considered an economic juggernaut, a power militarily and economically equal to our own, and we are not going to win because we cannot influence a government that doesn't care about world opinion. So we might get our picture in the paper for a while, but then it's over. We just bang our head on the wall. And it's not the principle that we're trying to uphold and the violation of human rights that we're really protesting. It's just the service of ourselves to make us feel like we're changing the world. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, one time I saw this big march here on campus about apartheid. And I thought,
About 15 or 20,000 American students gave up their U.S. citizenship, moved to South Africa, and became voting whites, and a generation would be gone. No firebombing, no riots, no, upset, seizure.
Riots?
You know, when you change government too fast, you have this horrible chaos and destruction. I mean, none of that would happen. But to do that, these people would have to give up their summers off while they're in school, and their gold jewelry, which is mine in South Africa, and their diamonds, which are mine in South Africa, and their cool clothes, which they wouldn't be able to afford it. I mean, see, they could have accomplished the whole thing without ever picketing, screaming, or breaking windows. But it would cost them.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the difference between true moral decency and a cause and just, you know, making noise and being seen.
And that's a great example of my next point. Not only the faddish character, but the symbolic character of the modern liberal attitude. It's much more impressed with and concerned with symbolism than substance. He's just put his finger right on that one, and that's an excellent example of that. We don't want it to actually cost us. We just want to feel good about ourselves. We want to feel morally superior for the position that I'm standing behind rather than actually do something about it. And I think you can point over and over and over and over and over again to that reality. I can remember during the Vietnam War, this was the funniest thing I ever heard. I was living in California at the time, and somebody told me about some people that every noon hour went in front of the city hall in San Mateo. I mean, as if the city hall in San Mateo was going to stop the war in Vietnam to start with. But they stood in front of the city hall at San Mateo, and they wore a little button that said something like peace. I mean, I don't even think it had anything to do with Vietnam. It just said peace. And they just stood there their whole noon hour. They didn't say anything. They didn't speak to anybody. They just quietly stood there and wore their pin. And why were they doing this? To protest the war in Vietnam.
Because they had their noon hour.
And they had their new nowhere else.
Money. And they didn't risk their jobs.
And that was just another example of the kind of thing you're talking about to me. They are feeling like they are doing something without doing anything of any substance to help anybody. And yet, that's important to this mentality, to this liberal mentality, that's important. Because as long as I can feel enlightened, that's really, in the end, what satisfies this mentality, I think. Seems to be.
Church and Lady United, Eugene.
Yeah. Now, that's not to say that there are not real activists. There certainly are. But the activists tend to be radical left-wing people more than really liberals. Because the radical left-wing, which also includes liberal ideals, but radical left-wing goals include we have to go out and stop, put an end to the social injustice and the inequality and so on. And they're willing to be activists and do something about it. Okay, I've talked about these left-wing ideals. We're running out of time. Let me get to evangelical liberalism and answer Tina's question. It seems to me that what has happened in evangelicalism, a certain stream in evangelicalism, is a synthesis between the modern liberal attitude, which is itself a synthesis of traditional liberalism and left-wing policies. It is itself that. And then the modern liberal attitude is evangelical. Okay, there's this. And then that coming together with principles taken from biblical Christianity form this evangelical form of political liberalism. So this isn't, strictly speaking, just the modern liberal attitude. It's very much constrained by commonsensical, true, faithful biblical principles. I mean, there's some very serious boundaries that the Bible and Christianity itself puts on evangelical liberalism, at least in its best forms. I think there are forms of it where you begin to wonder. But So this certainly, when we talk about liberal political agenda in evangelical circles, it's certainly not as extreme as what you find in American society generally. It's much more sane than that. But nonetheless, it is a synthesis with the realities of the modern liberal mind and mentality and culture, including its being affected by fads and fashions. I think a classic example, in fact, I just got on the internet last night and got on Sojourners Online. Sojourners Magazine is founded by Jim Wallis. I met Jim Wallis at Stanford in the 60s. He was coming through trying to recruit people for the radical Christian left. And he was moderately successful, formed a community, formed a magazine called Sojourners Magazine that's still with us to this day. And I read an article or a newsletter kind of thing on the internet last night that he had written about a conference that they had in Washington, D.C., and he was just sort of reporting on the conference and how smashingly successful it was and what great progress they had made. But it was very interesting because he explicitly said there what I had seen in the magazine over the years. These evangelical liberals have a real problem with issues of gay rights and abortion. On the one hand, they're biblical enough that it's very difficult for them to come out and advocate abortion, and it's very difficult for them to come out and altogether advocate homosexuality, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's very clear that they feel the pull of the fashionable, faddish nature of those as liberal causes. They refuse to be identified with the bad guys, the religious right, on these particular issues. They refuse. If they oppose abortion, it's got to be for different reasons. And if they oppose abortion, it's, you know, there's some really distinctive differences in the way that they oppose abortions, because whatever else they are, they're not those ignorant, fascist, hateful Nazi right-wingers. Whatever they are, they're not that. And it's just dripping with a desire to distance themselves from the right on those issues, even though it's supposedly from the same source, they're coming to the same ethic, and they're coming to the same ethical conclusion. But they don't want to be seen as conservative, of all things. They want to be seen as liberal. Same thing on gay rights. They're going to be against homosexuality because the Bible teaches you to be against homosexuality, but maybe not. I mean, there are some within their circles that would even oppose that and say, no, homosexuality is just fine. But some of them, the more conservative among them, are going to be against homosexuality, but they're going to be for gay rights, and they're going to be for, I mean, obviously, because liberty isn't rights and liberty is what it's all about. So they're going to be for gay rights, and they're going to be for compassion for homosexuals, and then so on and so forth, as if conservatives were not, and some of them are not, but there's nothing about conservatism that makes you lacking in compassion, per se. But that's going to be the perception. So you see this incredible pull in their midst to, on the one hand, conform to the enlightenment of liberal ideals and liberal causes and liberal fashions and liberal fads, on the one hand. But on the other hand, they're attempting to be biblical enough that they feel the pull of biblical truth at the same time. So they're in a real bind. They have a real tension. And my point is, to that degree, they are not unaffected by this faddish nature of modern liberalism.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the pull is genuine in that some of the liberals bring out some of the hypocrisy that's in the conservative group of people. I mean, you hear some people talk about gays as if they're some lower form of life.
Sure. Yeah.
They're around, and that's definitely... And I think this is just a backlash against that group of people. So.
Well, if it were just that, I mean, then I would be one of them. I mean, I would be among their ranks. But I don't think it's just that, because they would equally point to people who have never shown an ounce of genuine hatred or contempt in their life, but just on the basis of their ethics alone would dismiss them as rightist or conservative or something, or Nazi, yeah. So I think it's more than just responding to things that any Christian would find abhorrent, any kind of hatred that a Christian should find abhorrent. I think it's more than that, at least among this group, the Sojourners community. I mean, they're genuinely, what he was saying in this newsletter is this was a hot debate in their community as to what stand to take on abortion and gay rights. And it just wasn't clear to them what position to take. Well, my goodness. If that's not clear, what is? And you're attempting to be biblical. If that's not clear, where are you going to go for clarity? So there's something else. There's some other force at work there other than just an attempt to come to terms with biblical truth.
Do though with how they view the Bible, how they interpret it.
Yes.
And it gets more down to a liberal type of interpretation and so on.
Yeah. One of the things that I have noticed all along, you see it in Ron Sider, you see it in Tom Sine, you see it in all the... Now, Tom Sine and Ron Sider, this is an answer to Tina's question, are coming from the perspective of... theirs is not so much liberal as left-wing, in that they really see it crucially important that individuals and governments act compassionately. And they would consider that to be a biblical priority and a biblical injunction. It's absolutely essential that we address the problems of economic injustice, social injustice, the unequal distribution of wealth, and so on. And we need to fix that. And it's being totally unchristian and totally irresponsible as Christians to not address that problem and indeed solve that problem, attempt to solve that problem. Well, that's a left-wing set of goals and priorities. And one thing that you notice in among them is that they do terrible exegesis, just terrible. And the reason is because their left-wing priorities have already given them the answers to their question. They already know what they believe about those things. It's just a question of finding where the Bible supports that and tells them that. So you go to something like the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. Well, you know, we know how they're going to interpret that. Blessed are the poor. We know how they're going to interpret that. Any time that any language could possibly be construed in such a way that it conformed to and supported the left-wing priorities and goals, that's what they're going to do. That's what they're going to say it means. Never mind that looking at it in its context, in the context of what Jesus really meant to say, what questions he was answering, what issues he was addressing, it has nothing to do with that. Never mind that they're going to proof text those verses as being the biblical teaching that supports them in their view that this is top number one absolute undeniable priority for all Christians.
Legalist is a term I've been hearing thrown around quite a bit, and it seems to be somebody who has an opinion about the doctrine or whatever in the scripture. If they're presented as though this is true and worthy of following, then they're called a liberal because...
And
I'm a legalist because then you have to do this.
Yeah.
And that's put on your big time that way.
Yeah. Yeah. But
I thought the meaning of legalist prior to this was someone who believed in works for salvation.
Yeah.
So it's being stretched.
And even that would need to be explored more thoroughly as to what exactly was wrong with relying on works for salvation. I mean, ultimately, what the Bible is against is not legalism per se. The word's never used in the New Testament. What the Bible is against is the kind of self-deception that thinks that I ever could successfully justify myself in God's eyes by keeping the law. That's what the Bible is against, that we should be meaning when we say, let's not be legalistic. That's what we should be meaning. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Anytime somebody takes truth and goodness and what's right seriously enough to make it a principle to live by, they are sometimes accused of being a legalist. That couldn't be further from the truth. It couldn't be more wrong-headed than that.
If some of these people take, it seems to me that they have to write off a lot of scripture, and as you say, just kind of do a whole bunch of gymnastics with the scriptures to make it read the way they want it to read. How could they even be phrased evangelical liberals, really? I mean,
well, evangelical is a pretty, like Republican is a pretty big tent.
So it means a little bit of everything.
Yeah, yeah. It really, especially these days, I mean, more and more it's becoming more and more inclusive of a lot of people.
So that church here in town, the Central, whatever it is, that has the homosexuals.
Central Presbyterian?
Yeah, Central Presbyterian.
Well, they wouldn't even call themselves evangelical, though.
They wouldn't?
No.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Yeah.
No, they spit at evangelical.
What do they believe then?
This stuff.
That's it.
Yeah.
Social type thing. Yeah.
Christianity is all about political activism. That's what it's for. I mean, that's what happens in these circles. Now, these happen to be the evangelical arm of that mentality. They don't even pretend to be evangelical. But there are evangelicals who have basically the same really fundamental disposition, and that is when you reduce Christianity right down to its kernel, right down to its essence, what is Christianity saying? It's saying, go out and fight for the oppressed. Go out and liberate the people that are being oppressed by the injustice out there. Go out and stand for them.
You had mentioned...
Period. I mean, nothing else. All the other stuff, the cross, the resurrection, anything else that Christianity would apparently be all about, it's just sort of trappings to help support us in our belief that what we really need to do is to go out and become socially and politically active to help free the underdog.
You had mentioned a while back to me, I brought to you some stuff in the Minor Prophets. You said that the Minor Prophets are something that I think you said the evangelical liberals tend to use.
Yeah.
Can you kind of elaborate?
Well, because you have in the Minor Prophets, you have prophets of God coming to Israel, and among the things that they criticize Israel for is the social injustice that is happening in their midst. And yeah, absolutely. But here's the difference. Biblical Christianity should not repudiate the importance, the necessity, and the appropriateness of prophetic denunciation of social injustice. Absolutely. Social injustice is evil. It's a symptom of the evil of the human heart. It's abhorrent. It's outrageous. It's ridiculous. It's all of that. But what makes biblical Christianity different from this evangelical liberalism is the left-wing part of their assumptions and goals tells them what's absolutely essential is that we fix it, or at least strive to fix it. What's absolutely essential is that we become active to do something about it. So that's why if you read a book by Tom Sein, for example, there's a very clear, overwhelming tone to the book. And the tone is, you really better feel guilty if you use aluminum cans. Or you really better feel guilty if you fly on an airplane. Never mind that he does. But you really better feel guilty if you are a consumer. You really better feel guilty. Because, I mean, that's clearly the overwhelming tone of his book. I mean, you feel just terrible after reading this book. Ooh, do I dare breathe? I'm doing something awfully unchristian and ungodly and terrible by even existing. Pardon me?
Depends on where you live, if you dare breathe.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm from L.A., so you can understand.
But the reason for that is because these kind of left-wing perspective that he brings to the understanding of Christianity that sees the whole message of Christianity to be me taking responsibility and taking on the burden of eliminating social problems. And I must bear that burden, or I'm not being a good disciple. I'm not being a good Christian if I don't do that. it seems like a biblical Christian's perspective is, you know what? This world is a mess, and it's going to stay a mess no matter what I eat and not eat. Because the problem is so deep and rooted so deep that there's nothing I can do that can possibly fix the problem. Is that a reason to be irresponsible? No, it's not a reason to be irresponsible. But it's a reason to lighten up and recognize that my hope is not in building the kingdom of God here on this earth. My hope is that this whole place is going to be destroyed and God's going to start over with something that's made right. That's the hope of biblical Christianity, it seems to me. Now, what's the motivation for social activism and political activism to the extent that it might be appropriate if God so calls me? The motivation is not because I think I can be successful at solving the social ills. The motivation is, for my own soul's sake, I need to stand against evil. I need to repudiate it. I need to reject it. I need to renounce it. I need to not allow it to swallow me up. I need to oppose it. And that's perfectly appropriate. And that may translate into a kind of activism for some people at some time. But it may simply be a prophetic denunciation for other Christians. For me to compromise, and in the context of people refuse to say, out of fear of other people, I think abortion is wrong, that, I think, is a failure of my Christian principles. It's a failure of my faith. It's a failure of my commitment to the righteousness of the kingdom of God. But that's a failure to be a prophet when I need to be a prophet, like the minor prophets. It's a failure to look at my society and say, my society is sick, when I know it's sick and when I believe it's sick. To fail to say that is a significant kind of failure. That's one thing. But it's a whole other thing to become a pro-life activist who feels that it is their duty to shut abortion clinics down and to kill abortion doctors and, you know, whatever else that we do, as if the end were to somehow fix this evil in society. I can't fix this evil in society. The evil in society, if I stop abortion, this evil in society is going to manifest itself somewhere else. When am I going to stop fixing it? I can't fix it without fixing the human heart. Now, it may be an appropriate part of my prophetic ministry to be an activist, an anti-abortion pro-life activist. I'm not. I don't feel called to that. I don't feel the urgency of that. My calling is to proclaim the truth and teach the truth and explain the truth. And everyone is going to have a slightly different calling. But what makes biblical Christianity distinctively different from this one is you cannot not be an activist in this way of thinking. You are not even being a disciple if you're not being an activist in evangelical liberal thinking. Whereas in my perspective, if you're if you're an activist, it's because you've been called by God to that particular calling to be an activist in some particular way, not because it's part of your discipleship as such.
The way they treat the Bible, per se. I mean,
and that would be another one. It's just,
yeah.
I mean, they could bend the biblical text to make it say that you have to do that to be a disciple.
We might say, God bless you, go ahead, try to solve poverty if you want. Do it. It's not my calling, and I'll support you if I can. But we can't support them in their treatment of the scriptures.
Yeah, in their perverting the essence of Christianity in order to just... Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I would say that the principle is the same with the evangelical liberalism and the liberal theology.
And liberal theology?
Yeah. How do you think about these relationships?
Well, the... You know, people like Tony Campolo, for example, I shouldn't speak. I don't really know his stuff that well.
I heard Tony Campolo speak one time, and he did seem to hit on the point about a lot of what you do is something that feeds your soul. So I'm sure
okay.
He says a lot of things that people go, whoa, but just the one thing I heard, I was surprised when I listened to him that it was more than just a lot of yelling, you better get out there and do this. There was a lot of thought into it.
Okay.
You know, he was talking about people being spiritually unfed, and that's why they don't have the energy to go out and basically do the things that they do because they're spiritually vacant. And
okay.
I think he feels maybe there's a symbiotic relationship. Anyways.
And in any case, correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess is that he takes the Bible seriously. Yeah, at least, I don't know how he is as an interpreter of it. There's two ways to not take it seriously. One is to believe in its authority and then rearrange what it says. The other way is to believe in it, is to just reject it as having any authority at all. And I think that's what liberal theology does, is I don't think it really takes the Bible seriously to start with in terms of granting it any real authority. Any authority that they granted is just kind of a historical accident. It just happens to be the literature of our tradition, you know, that kind of stuff. But I don't think they are really seriously granting it any authority. Well, evangelicals, at least in principle, would look to the Bible and say, yes, the Bible is our authority. So that's what puts them apart from liberal theology.
Are you talking about liberal theology or liberation theology? Because liberation theology seems to be kind of the mirror image,
Did you say liberation?
No, I mean, liberation theology.
Okay. Yes, these are very close. And in fact, they talk to each other and they can't tell the difference between one another either. With this possible exception, liberation theology is, you know, in my lecture, I linked it with postmodern hermeneutics. I do think you're less likely to find any evangelical liberal, advocating that we go out and practice our faith first and then read our Bible in the light of what we do, which is what liberation theology explicitly says. I think these guys do the same thing, but they would never get caught dead saying that that's what they're doing. Because they're evangelical enough to believe that we really need to make the Bible our authority and we really need to listen to what it's really saying. Now, I'm not sure they really do that because I think they're far, far too willing to put their radical New Left lenses on when they read it. They just don't admit that that's what they're doing. So they will tell me that what they're doing is just listening to the teaching of Jesus. Well, never mind that I read the teaching of Jesus and it sure sounds like he's saying something different than what they think he's saying. But from their perspective, they're being faithful to what the Bible's teaching. And in that respect, they may be less honest than liberation theologians are. I mean, not that they're trying to defraud. I think they sincerely believe that they're really seeing what Jesus is saying, but they're just blind to the fact that they've got really thick lenses, really thick left-wing lenses on that they don't know they have on, I think.
Where I go, the way it's handled, pointed out Sunday that many of the heroes of the faith, modern centuries or late centuries, have some things right, but they were wrong about this, and they were wrong about this, and they were wrong about this, and then there was so-and-so, and he was wrong about this, and wrong about this, and wrong about this. Uh-huh. And it was naming the negatives, and the stance is within the church that the various doctrines that have been held by the conservative Baptist, you could have been wrong. And they're presented as not able to complete the doctrine and take a firm stand on it because it's too, what's said about that doctrine is too incomplete. And therefore, you can't formulate a doctrine. So if you have a doctrine, keep it to yourself and your beliefs. We don't want to hear those. The whole thing is shut down because the Bible is not complete enough to make a doctrine. And that way, and I mean, I'm hearing this same thing that you're talking about is just another slant in what you have mentioned.
This is happening in the Baptist church?
Yes, that's amazing.
And guess what? The conservative Baptist is what gets me, you know?
Yeah.
And you look at, like it's the name of it is the Conservative Baptist Association, started in Henson. Association, because in those days, the tied together, what was it? A convention. And so they hated the word convention because that meant that they were owned by the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And the point here was to make it so all these churches come together as an association only. But now that word is being dropped. And it's my strong opinion that the push is
Somebody's
for...
Somebody's running for dictator?
One, Dictator? Yeah, like the one guy said when they introduced top man of Northwest, Larry, and some guy stood up and said, "The Pope!" I laughed my head off. I thought it was funny. And he quipped back. He says, "Would that man like to come down here? I've got something I'd like him to kiss." Kind of went wild on this, but I'm not laughing anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm really not laughing anymore. The man had it right, and I took it as a joke, and I think he meant it as a joke, but no joke.
That's too bad. Well, I'm running out of time. Let me make sure I've even begun to answer your question in it.
Kind of. When did evangelicalism have its birth, would you say?
Okay, in the 1940s or 50s, probably. Well, what you the predecessor, the spiritual predecessor to evangelicalism would be fundamentalism. And what would that be, the 20s, 1920s, or just the early part of the century? Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, what I'm calling evangelicalism, I mean, in a way, you've had the evangelicals are kind of the spiritual ancestors of the Reformation. So you could go all the way back to Luther and Calvin in a sense, but this is a particular manifestation of a particular branch of the family of the Reformers, and it really didn't have its birth until, in some ways, Carl Henry. Are you familiar with Carl Henry? In some respects, he's sort of the father of evangelicalism. What early evangelicals tried really hard to distinguish themselves from fundamentalists. And the reason being, one of the distinctives of fundamentalism at the time was because they rejected the social gospel. Are you all familiar with the social gospel? It was basically came out of a liberal theological view that was largely socialist. And we wanted to bring about the kingdom of God here on earth through social activism and the establishment, really, of socialism in our governments. That was the social gospel. Now, that was its theory. In practice, the social gospel included just, you know, doing lots of good things, orphanages and feeding poor people and so on. But what the fundamentalists were reacting to was not the doing of those good things. They had been doing those for centuries. People like fundamentalists have been doing those kinds of things for centuries. But the social gospel was distinctive, and it was not only doing that, but it was fighting for labor unions and engaged in political activism of an ideological nature in order to bring about and establish socialism and to make it part of the fabric of our society. Well, the fundamentalists looked at that and understandably rejected it, probably on two counts. One, it was socialistic, and they rejected socialism. But even more importantly, they saw that it had this is a terrible imagery, but it had defanged the gospel. I guess that's not what I mean. It had neutered and trivialized the gospel, because no longer was proclaiming the gospel important. From a social gospel perspective, what was important is that we transform society and bring about the kingdom of God here on earth. Fundamentalists said, wait a minute, what about the age to come? What about the kingdom of God? Isn't saving people's souls far more important and far more vital than establishing socialism here in our country? And I think they very rightly rejected the social gospel. Henry suggested that they threw the baby out with the bathwater, that not only did they reject what was wrong-headed about the social gospel, but they also kind of steered away from social action altogether. And the kind of prophetic voice that you find in the Minor Prophets and that a biblical Christian, I think, should find perfectly appropriate, criticizing our country for its evil policies, for its unjust policies, for evil that's entrenched in its institutions, that's not unbiblical. You know, for us to stand up and say this is rotten and this stinks. In the 50s, I mean, I just remember even in my childhood. Well, Vietnam was a watershed in our country. That was really, really brought in all kinds of changes in our country. before Vietnam, it was standard in your churches to make patriotism very, very much a part of spirituality. I think that's gone now. And frankly, as it should be. Because the nature and degree of patriotism, it was a kind of, it was far too willing to swallow too much. It was unpatriotic to be critical. I mean, it seemed to me, maybe that's my perception as a child, and maybe it's a warped perception, but my perception as a child, or a young adolescent, was that patriotism meant you didn't criticize your country. Well, you know, tell that to Amos and Joel. If you were being disobedient to God, you were being disobedient to God, and it's important that we say so. So Henry rightly saw that fundamentalism had kind of drifted toward an unwillingness to be critical, an unwillingness to make any sort of social critique, an unwillingness to call injustice injustice and evil evil in its institutional forms, and a resistance to even be socially active at all. And so in order to distance evangelicalism from fundamentalism, he coined this word, evangelical, to describe a person who believed in all the principles, all the theological principles of fundamentalism on the one hand, but did not share this kind of fundamentalist aversion to social critique and social activism. At least that's where evangelicalism started. Now, what's happened since then is, wow, how would you describe it? I mean,
it started out more conservative in its nature, and then it slowly kind of split off.
Well, I mean, to Carl Henry, I mean, Carl Henry is still writing to this day, and he's horrified at what he sees happening, because he believes in truth, he believes in reason, he believes in the Bible and the authority of the Bible, he believes in the inerrancy of the Bible. He's really a champion of the foundations of biblical Christianity, I think, and certainly the Reformed view of biblical Christianity. But although he, the influx of the attitudes that you find in the charismatic movement, the kind of relativism that you find in evangelicalism today, the disregard for doctrine as if it's not even important, the downplaying of the importance of theology, I mean, he would just abhor all of that trend in evangelicalism today. So I'm not really, frankly, I don't know how you would define evangelicalism today. It's just more, it really comes down to, if you answered the question, do you believe that it's important to be born again? And I'm not even sure that would be essential anymore. But
pushed hard there.
Well, scripture would be part of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, just saying there's a commitment to...
Well, you would think so, except that you have these books that have just come out by... Well, Hunter, the sociologist from Virginia, has done research and put out a couple of books where he's done sociological research. He's polled people at evangelical seminaries as to their attitudes and beliefs, and it's just phenomenal the percentage of them that don't believe in the authority of the Bible and don't believe in stuff that are distinctively evangelical, and they call themselves evangelicals, yeah. So it's just, I mean, everything's crumbling. I mean, it's just... all any definition to it is just being lost completely, it seems to me.
Evangelical liberalism, the Cartelli Oricon.
I'm sorry, say that.
There's some books by Henry Carl.
Carl Henry.
Yeah. About could you introduce us?
He has his magnum opus is a book called... it's a five-volume series. It's pretty dense and pretty thick. I mean, it's heavy theology. I think it's Reason, Revelation, and Authority, I believe. But take that with a grain of salt. I may not have that right. Five volumes. His name is Carl Henry. And he wrote that relatively recently. He was... I think he's still alive, but he must be in his 90s, or he's really up there. And he probably wrote this in his 80s or late 70s. So it's an older man putting together his life's thinking. I actually haven't read much of it. And then you could probably, and he was pretty prolific, so you could find other works, and probably works where he describes the birth of evangelicalism.
Kind of a lighter note. Francis Schaeffer, now I know that in his history, he came out of a Presbyterian church, I think it was, and I know that he changed over to a more evangelical, would it be independent church? Is that basically where he entered into more of a, because that was back in the late 40s, early 50s, I think is when that all occurred.
I think he still stayed in his beliefs pretty Presbyterian to the end. I mean, I don't think he ever really abandoned his commitment to Presbyterian principles. At least I'm not aware that he did. Well, let's call it an evening. I didn't actually get to some of the most important critiques, but maybe some other time.